Hi, Marco Werman here. We've been hearing from so many listeners like you about how and why you listen to the world. How you listen? While walking your dog, making dinner, on your commute home, or with your students during a middle school history class you teach. Why? Because you value our diverse and broad perspectives. You appreciate the way that we find people at the heart of the news without doom and gloom, and how we provide insightful journalism and unique stories you won't find just anywhere. By now, you know we've set an ambitious fundraising goal before the end of the year. We have the chance to unlock a $67,000 matching gift, which will double your impact. But we still need 427 listeners to donate $100 each to get there. It sounds like a lot, but I know we can do it. We've done it before. And we need you. We won't get there without you. If you value our coverage, if you can't imagine your world without the world, please donate today. Every single gift will bring us closer to the goal. Visit theworld.org/give and donate today. That's theworld.org/give. On the U.S.-Mexico border in El Paso, more Central American migrants heading north trying to seek asylum.
There's about several hundred people waiting in the cold and freezing temperatures on the north bank of the Rio Grande, which is just south of the U.S. border fence.
Once on this side, authorities and aid workers are overwhelmed. Also today, Iran loses its seat on a U.N. Commission for Women's Rights.
This will be seen definitely as a slap and as an indication that the international community is really quite upset with Iran's long-standing discrimination against women.
I'm Marco Werman, plus unlocking the secrets of whales.
Reach! Straight ahead!
Learning how whales communicate could be critical for preserving biodiversity. That's not just good for whales, but also for the rest of us. Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. Thousands of migrants continue to arrive in El Paso, Texas. Shelters are overflowing and relief workers are overwhelmed. All this is happening as the pandemic restriction Title 42 is set to expire next week. The Trump-era public health order allowed U.S. authorities to expel migrants without a chance to apply for asylum. To discuss all of this, I'm joined by reporter Lauren Villagran with the El Paso Times. She joins us from the fence in El Paso that separates the U.S. from Mexico. Lauren, what are you seeing in terms of people on the move right now?
Hi, Marco. There is about several hundred people waiting in the cold and freezing temperatures on the north bank of the Rio Grande, which is just south of the U.S. border fence. And they've been waiting overnight, in some cases, for hours or more than a day to seek asylum in the U.S.
And is it clear where most of them are coming from?
Right now, we're seeing a lot of folks from Nicaragua. They can't be expelled under Title 42. The U.S. doesn't have a working relationship with Nicaragua, and Mexico is not accepting Nicaraguans right now. But it may be presaging what's to come next week when Title 42 ends.
Right. So with the news that Title 42 is set to expire next week, help us understand the connection between that sundowning of this Trump-era rule and the migrants who continue to cross into El Paso.
Well, Title 42 in many ways suspended the U.S. asylum system. So previously, migrants could approach a port of entry and seek asylum in a perhaps more orderly fashion. Since the expulsions, folks are approaching the border, they're being processed in, and many are being summarily returned either to their country of origin or back to Mexico. When Title 42 goes away, the U.S. government won't have that option to immediately expel people.
So how are relief agencies right now dealing with this massive influx of people coming into El Paso?
It's a humanitarian crisis. The Border Patrol is processing in hundreds, in some cases more than 2,000 people per day. Those who cannot be expelled and who also pass a criminal background check are released either to the city, the county, or non-governmental organizations that run shelters, who basically take people in until they can head to their destination in the United States. DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was here in El Paso. He has promised more resources to the border, but definitely the relief agencies are overwhelmed.
And Lauren, you spoke with the Secretary Mayorkas this week. What's he saying about how active the border is and what the government's plans are moving forward?
Secretary Mayorkas did not reveal the specifics of what plans are going to be put in place when Title 42 is lifted, but any new limits on asylum or any limits on access to the U.S. southern border are going to depend heavily on cooperation from Mexico. He did confirm that the U.S. government is deep in negotiations with the Mexican government right now.
Is this happening in other parts of Texas along the border? Why such a surge in El Paso?
People choose different parts of the border for different reasons. Right now, you know, there is a system in place in El Paso, and people are lining up, sort of organizing themselves on the north bank of the Rio Grande. I spoke with one Nicaraguan man this morning who said, you know, even though it looks like people just sort of conglomerating, there actually is order. They've formed a line. They've tied blankets together to cordon off the area. And all of that in the absence of any real process on the part of the U.S. government.
So 1 week from today, December 21st, Title 42 expires. I'm wondering if what you're seeing right now in El Paso is a snapshot of what comes next week. What are you expecting to see?
When all nationalities are able to access the border and know that they won't be expelled, you are going to see a large uptick. Now, Secretary Mayorkas did share the message that the U.S. government is going to increase expedited removals, so those who do not have a valid asylum claim can be deported. You know, so the visuals at the border of people being processed in does not mean that all of those people are going to get to stay.
If they don't get to stay, then what is the plan?
I don't know if we're going to start seeing an increase in U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement rounding up people in communities across the country? Are we going to see increased interior enforcement? I don't know. It's really too soon to tell.
Lauren Villagran, a reporter with the El Paso Times, joining us from the border fence in El Paso a week before Title 42 is set to expire. Lauren, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Now to China, which looks pretty different than it did just a week ago. Gone is the country's controversial zero COVID policy, just weeks after top government officials in Beijing vowed to stay the course. The World's China correspondent Rebecca Canther has the latest from Shanghai.
This has been the constant soundtrack in shops, vegetable markets, and on public transportation throughout China. It's a recorded announcement asking people to scan a QR code for digital contact tracing. Now, those recordings have gone silent. Over the past week, it seems like a different COVID policy has been dropped every day. Last Tuesday, Beijing announced that mandatory testing would be abandoned. Then on Wednesday, the government announced that people with COVID could quarantine at home instead of in quarantine camps. 2 days ago, a national-level contact tracing app was dismantled. With fewer people getting tested, numbers of reported positive cases are plummeting. The graph of reported cases looks like the edge of a steep cliff. But actual infections seem to be surging. Jackie Deng, a lawyer in Beijing, says COVID is spreading quickly in her circle. It's hard to find someone here who hasn't gotten infected yet, she says. She and her two kids came down with COVID a few days ago. So far, she says, they're experiencing mild cases and are resting at home. Schools around the country are switching to online classes as the virus spreads among students and teachers. Students at many universities have been sent home early for winter break to avoid further spread before the upcoming Lunar New Year holidays. With the sudden dropping of COVID precautions, some are concerned about the way forward. Wu Dongxiu, a childcare worker in Shanghai, is among them. The mandatory testing was to protect vulnerable people, like my relatives, who have underlying conditions, she says. Without testing, that puts them more at risk. Mobile COVID testing booths here are now closing. The ones that remain have signs in the windows that read, "Don't get tested unless you need to." Liu Guzi, a PhD student in Wuhan, says the speed of the policy shift has left many unprepared. She's been trying to stock up on medicine for her family members. I'm worried about the older generation. Their immunity might not be as strong. But it's hard to find ibuprofen or TCM cold medication, she says. fever medicines are sold out at pharmacies and online shops. Liu says she's asking friends to send her any extra medicine they might have on hand. Today, Pfizer's Paxlovid antiviral medication went on sale in China and sold out in just a half hour, even though it cost $400 a dose. Top health officials are trying to calm concerns, telling people that this variant of COVID is comparable to the flu. But there are fears that China's healthcare system will not be able to cope with the rising number of cases. At a press conference today, Zhao Yaohui from China's National Health Commission said that they were taking precautionary measures. That includes increasing the number of fever clinics at hospitals and encouraging people, especially the elderly, to get vaccinated. But some who have resisted getting vaccinated till now are still holding out. Ying Jun, who runs a small photocopy shop in Shanghai, decided not to get the vaccine because she's concerned about potential side effects. The virus is less strong than before. I'm not worried. I'll just have to be careful, she says. She puts on a mask as we talk. She and many people I talk to are feeling positive. Jackie Deng, the lawyer in Beijing who's sick at home with COVID, says the sudden lift of COVID controls has her feeling hopeful again. This change, it doesn't scare me, she says. Actually, it makes me happy. For the past few years, I've felt so much stress and pressure. Now that we finally got COVID, I feel relieved, she says. It's like it's ending. COVID is, of course, not ending here, but the trend of dropping precautionary measures looks poised to continue. Yesterday, Hong Kong announced it would abandon mandatory quarantines for incoming travelers. Rumors are spreading that mainland China will follow soon. For the world, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
A quick note about the Democratic Republic of Congo in Central Africa. In Kinshasa, the capital, a disaster that has killed more than 100 people, widespread floods and landslides. Heavy rains began on Monday night, with deaths and injuries being reported throughout Tuesday. Prime Minister Jean-Michel Sama Lukonde said officials were still searching for more bodies. According to officials there, people most affected by the floods live in housing that was built without official permits. Kinshasa is home to more than 15 million people, some 12 million of whom live in the neighborhoods impacted by the floods. Back now to a story we've been keeping tabs on, the removal of a president in Peru and the demonstrations that have erupted into violence. Across Peru, thousands of people have taken to the streets. They're demanding new elections and the release of former President Pedro Castillo. Castillo was arrested last week for attempting to dissolve Peru's Congress in a move to avoid impeachment on multiple corruption charges. Instead, the military detained him, and his vice president, Dina Boluarte, became the new president. That brought people into the streets. Dina Boluarte no nos representa. This protester in the city of Arequipa called Boluarte a traitor and said she should be in jail for the deaths of Peruvian demonstrators in recent days. At least six people have died in clashes, including five teenagers. That's according to Peruvian officials. Former President Castillo appeared in court yesterday. He urged security forces to stop killing people whom he said are thirsty for justice. Castillo is a former union activist and farmer. He won the presidency last year, promising to empower poor and indigenous Peruvians. But once he came to office, Castillo did not propose any significant changes. Instead, he was hampered by multiple corruption allegations, leading finally to his arrest. Meanwhile, the new president, Dina Boluarte, has been calling for calm. She said she's never given instructions to police to use any lethal weapons, not even rubber bullets. Boluarte once campaigned for the now-impeached President Castillo, but since his ouster, Boluarte says his actions were an attempted coup. Besides demanding new immediate elections, demonstrators have also called for the dissolution of Congress and a new constitution. World Cup soccer is all about today's big match between Morocco and France. The underdog Atlas Lions have tapped into fan bases in both Africa and the Middle East. We'll talk about Morocco's twin identities just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. In Turkey, that apparently is not the case. Today, a court there sentenced the mayor of Istanbul to 2.5 years in jail for using the term fool to describe election officials. The world's Duri Bhaskaran is in Istanbul and is on the line to explain what's going on and what it means for Turkish politics. Hi, Duri.
Hi, Marco.
So it seems the crime was using a word, that word being fool, right?
Right. I mean, in Turkish, it's called ahmak. It's a fairly mild insult, most often translated into English as fool, but could also be moron or idiot.
Okay, so a mild insult and a prison sentence for calling someone an idiot. That seems pretty harsh. Who is this politician and how did this all happen?
So this politician at the center of all of this is Ekrem İmamoğlu. He's the mayor of Istanbul. And he's considered one of Turkish President Erdogan's most well-known political rivals because he manages the largest city in the country, Istanbul. Now, that's over 16 million people who live here, which is more than, if you think about it, the entire state of Pennsylvania. When Ekrem İmamoğlu first won his election back in 2019, an election board overruled the popular vote and called for a re-election. It was considered a widely political move, but then İmamoğlu won again. And a few months later, in a press conference, he said that the repeat of the election, this whole political fiasco, affected Turkey's standing in the world. He said that those who were responsible were fools. Now, this word, this label, set off an entire court case, which has been widely considered to be politically motivated, and the verdict came down just a couple of hours ago. 2 years, 7 months, 15 days in prison for a politician that was considered one of the top contenders to run against Erdogan in the presidential elections in June.
Yeah, June of next year. That seems pretty significant. What's the reaction been like where you are in Istanbul, Duri?
It's been big. Just a couple hours ago, I went to the municipal office where İmamoğlu had asked his supporters to gather outside while the verdict was coming. I would say several hundred people were gathered there. It had spilled out into a park on the other side of the street. I mean, people were just there. They were playing political music and having speeches. I asked a group of ladies from Istanbul why they came out, and a woman named Hatice said they wanted to show support for İmamoğlu.
İmamoğlu için buradayız, destekçisiyiz, yanındayız. Hak, hukuk, adalet istiyoruz.
Hatice is using a popular catchphrase. She says she wants justice and the rule of law. I also spoke to a student named Mehmet, who said he was furious when the first election results were canceled.
Şu an demokrasiyi kurtarıyorum gibi tümtıraklı laflar da etmek istemiyorum.
He said he felt this strong need to come and be here. He felt it in his blood. He says he doesn't want to say like he's single-handedly defending democracy or anything, but he felt like it was his duty to show up.
So national elections in Turkey, June of next year. This is the mayor of Istanbul, a significant center of power, and that mayor has his eyes on the presidency. What does this story tell us more deeply about Turkish politics ahead of the presidential race?
I mean, İmamoğlu will have a chance to appeal this court's decision. If it's affirmed, he may be banned from politics altogether. So this appeal could last until after the elections, but I think the wider issue is what this means for Turkish democracy. İmamoğlu isn't the only politician on trial. I mean, the leader of a pro-Kurdish party is already in prison, and Kurdish lawmakers are facing a separate trial that could ban their party from politics as well. All of these pressures on opposition lawmakers are usually an indication that the ruling party is feeling insecure, that they're losing popular support and they know it. But what happens in the next few months will tell us a lot.
So when does this term in prison actually start?
Well, so İmamoğlu has a chance to appeal, and they will go through that process. The higher court will affirm that decision or acquit him. So we really don't know if he actually will go to prison. There's a lot of steps before that would happen.
There was Duri Bhaskaran in Istanbul on a day when the mayor of that city is facing a 2.5-year prison sentence. Duri, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's something we did not see coming at this year's World Cup. Morocco making it all the way to the semifinals. Earlier today, though, the Moroccan dream came to an end. In a tough-fought match, the reigning champs from France took down the Atlas Lions by a score of 2-0. Much had been said and written about the colonizer facing the formerly colonized on the pitch, but we wanted to also recognize how Morocco's success has been celebrated across the Arab world. That has raised some questions about how people from Morocco, an African nation, actually identify. The world's Omar Douagi joins us to explain. Hey, Omar.
Hey, Marco.
We've seen this big conversation emerge in recent days about Morocco's place in the world. What have you noticed?
Of course, Marco, Morocco is part of the Arab world. It's a member of the Arab League, and the majority of Morocco's population speaks Darija, which is a dialect of Arabic. There's also a strong Berber presence in Morocco. The Berbers are an indigenous group in North Africa. They were there before the arrival of the Arabs and Islam to the region. Berbers have their own distinct languages, and they're trying to preserve them. But there's another complexity here, Marco. Just look at the map and you see that Morocco is in northern Africa. And that's a part of Morocco's story, too. It's got strong ties with African states, and it's a longtime member of the African Union.
So in this geographic and ethnic mix, how do Moroccans themselves understand all of these different aspects of identity?
Right. So I spoke about this with Intisar Fakir. She's a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute and a North Africa expert. She also happens to be Moroccan.
The short answer to how Moroccans identify, I would say it's all of the above. It's in a way very difficult to talk about, you know, being Moroccan as being purely Arab without an element of Berber in one's identity. And it's also the same to talk about Morocco as being purely Arab without some kind of element of African, you know, belonging and culture within that identity as well.
So I think the key point here, Marco, is that this question about Moroccan identity is a pretty complex one.
Yeah, so now with Morocco kind of at center stage on the pitch at the World Cup, how's this conversation playing out now?
It's been really interesting, Marco. For a long time, many Moroccans were told they're actually not Arab by other Arabs because of the mixed Arab-Berber heritage and because of their dialect of Arabic not being so familiar to other Arabic speakers. But the thing is, people across the Arab world have rallied to support Morocco at this World Cup. Also, Moroccan players and fans have been raising the Palestinian flag at every match, and that's gotten a lot of attention too.
Yeah, how is that going over with Palestinians?
Well, Palestinians, of course, love it. It's elevated their cause to the world's biggest stage, and there's been celebrations in the West Bank and Gaza after each Moroccan victory. I spoke about this with Hamza Ali Shah. He's a Palestinian writer and football fan living in London.
Definitely gives grounds for hope. For so long, it's felt like the Palestinian struggle has been invisibilized, almost deliberately at times as well, where it's kind of just become accepted that this is an ongoing occupation, it's an ongoing struggle, and therefore people have almost become desensitized to it. Whereas now, kind of seeing that as almost a reminder that the Palestinian struggle is still very much at the core of people's beliefs and very much in the hearts of people.
But is it, Omar? I mean, Morocco, not so long ago, normalized relations with Israel, along with other Arab countries in that Trump-era Abraham Accord, and that was to the detriment of the Palestinian cause. That was 2020. How should we understand that alongside the support of the World Cup for the Palestinian flag?
That's a great question, Marco. Freedom of expression can be hard to come by across the region, and there are strong feelings about this topic. I asked Intisar Fakir about this, and here's what she had to say.
There's a lot of good evidence from Morocco that, you know, people within the Moroccan population are happy to see stronger ties with Israel, but they also don't want to see the Palestinian cause forgotten. They don't want to see the plight of Palestinians overlooked. And I think this is, for many, as good a reminder as any to put that on top of the global agenda.
So again, Marco, I think the key point here when talking about politics in Morocco, like the people's sense of identity there, is that it's just not so simple.
This is a fascinating angle to the World Cup. And in a word, as you said, it is complex. The world's Omar Douaji. Thanks very much for this.
Thank you, Marco.
It's the world. As war rages in Ukraine, people in the former Soviet state of Kyrgyzstan want the outside world to know about their conflict, too.
Dear Western media, I know that we are not white enough for you to care that much, but please finish watching this video and dive a little deeper into the complexities of Putin's regime.
Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. For most of us here in the U.S., Facebook is a place to post pictures of family, friends, or pets, funny videos, maybe a place to try and sell some secondhand item. For the most part, innocent enough, but in some parts of the globe, the platform is leading to real-world violence. That's what a new billion-dollar lawsuit filed today in Kenya is alleging. From Nairobi, the world's Halima Gikandi has more.
Professor Ma'arug Amara Abraha was an accomplished academic in his home country of Ethiopia. He had dedicated a lifetime of research in the field of chemistry, mentored generations of Ethiopian students. His son, Abraham Ma'arug, says his father was beloved.
He was one of the most respected person in the region, in the country, by both his personality and his academic achievement.
Ma'arug describes his father as the type of person who never failed to visit his parents back in their home village or go out of his way to take care of sick relatives.
And he was a family man, And one of the most interesting things about him was he always pretended knowing nothing.
He pretended to know nothing, his son explains, so he could just listen to people instead. He begins to tear up as he remembers his father, who, even in old age, kept busy, writing dozens of chemistry articles and papers. Things like social media were a waste of time to the professor. But it was a social media platform, Ma'ruk says, that ultimately led to his father's murder, specifically Facebook.
I hold Facebook directly responsible for my father's murder.
Ma'ruk tells me it all began last year when the war in northern Ethiopia was at its height. Ma'ruk says Facebook became a channel for hate and violence. He tells me his own Facebook feed was full of graphic photos of dead bodies and genocidal language.
I almost report nearly 45 to 50 posts and almost one or two were removed.
Then last October, Ma'ruk says he saw Facebook posts that targeted his own father. Hate-filled, ethnically inflammatory posts. People were commenting on them, he says, calling for his father to be murdered. The post identified the professor's workplace and his neighborhood. Ma'ruk tells me he reported the post to Facebook and tried to get them taken down, but they stayed online. Within weeks, he says his father was gunned down outside of his home in northern Ethiopia. The killers left him to die on the street. And according to the affidavit, the men taunted their victim with similar language from posts on Facebook.
Facebook posts in October 9 and 10, it was considered a death sentence for our father. And that's why I'm just taking Facebook to the court.
Ma'ruk is part of this lawsuit filed today in Nairobi, where Facebook has a regional office. Content moderators also operate from here. Ma'ruk is joined by another Ethiopian petitioner and a Kenyan legal organization. They argue that Facebook has been putting profits over human rights. Mercy Mutemi is a lawyer on the case.
Both of my clients cannot go back to their country as it is right now, all arising from Facebook posts. What kind of a world are we living in when Facebook becomes the reason why we cannot enjoy our rights? That is the premises of the case we have made.
She says Facebook's algorithm promotes hateful speech and that content moderation is severely lacking in the region.
The algorithm has to be fixed and Facebook has to seriously invest in content moderation. And most importantly, we are not second-rate users. Africans deserve better.
By choosing not to invest more in content moderation, Mutemi says the company is discriminating against African users. The lawsuit is asking for more than $1.6 billion to create a fund for victims.
If you have been a victim of human rights violations leading or stemming from either the algorithmic choices or the content moderation choices, you can come to court, prove damage, and then you can be awarded damages from that fund.
I reached out to Facebook regarding this case. In a statement, the company said it does invest heavily in content moderation for Ethiopia and that it employs staff with local knowledge and language skills. But Abraham Ma'ruk says that's not sufficient. After his father was murdered, he says he had to flee Ethiopia. Now he's seeking asylum in the United States. To date, he says his father's body remains buried in an unmarked grave.
Our father is a victim of hate and disinformation, but we cannot bring him back. But we don't let other families to experience the same thing.
The deliberate negligence of Facebook, Ma'ruk says, needs to stop. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
In a vote at the United Nations today, Iran was ousted from its seat on the top women's rights panel at the organization. The tally was 29-8 with 16 abstentions. It was just last year that UN officials gave Iran a four-year term on the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. But following the death in September of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in the custody of Iran's so-called morality police, the U.S. led an effort to remove Iran from the commission. Iran scholar Barbara Slavin, soon to be a senior fellow at the Stimson Center, has been following the vote. So what message do you think this rebuke to Iran actually sends?
Iran does not have membership in that many international organizations. The United Nations is an important forum for Iran, and so this will be seen definitely as a slap and as an indication that the international community is really quite upset with Iran's treatment of the protesters and with Iran's longstanding discrimination against women.
Any surprise on who backed up Iran today and who backed down, Barbara?
There were a couple of questions that I had about why Bolivia or Nicaragua would have supported Iran. But, you know, Iran has tried very hard to maintain ties with other developing countries, particularly with leftist regimes in various countries. So perhaps that explains it. Iran also has been a prolific seller of small arms to African countries, interestingly enough. So that might have something to do with it. It's a blow to Iran, though. It's a blow to its prestige. And I think it's going to be very, very hard for the regime in Tehran to disguise its disappointment.
I mean, even before the recent protests and upheaval in Iran, it wasn't as if the country was a strong supporter of women's rights. How did Iran secure a seat on the UN's Commission on the Status of Women to begin with?
Well, I'm afraid that many of these UN commissions have memberships that are a little bit questionable. Look, you know, there's an effort sometimes to get countries like this on these sorts of bodies in hopes that it will actually persuade them to improve their own policies. But as we've seen in the case of Iran, that's certainly not true. But there are other commissions in UN bodies, human rights commissions and so on, that are full of human rights abusers. So Iran was hardly the outlier here. I think what happened, though, is that because of the nature of these protests and the very harsh repression that has followed, it simply became untenable to have Iran on this commission. And it's also a way for the United States and other countries to show their displeasure that does not involve, frankly, any sacrifice to ourselves. Iran is one of the most sanctioned countries in the world. There's very little more the U.S. can do or other countries can do to penalize it economically. But this is an important symbolic step.
So let's talk about this commission then. We know it has 45 members. They meet annually in March. Who are the commissioners on this group at the UN overseeing the status of women, and what do they do?
They have different work programs. They're supposed to be dealing with climate change and the impact of climate change on women this year. This is an organization that grew out of a very famous women's summit in Beijing in the 1990s. You may remember Hillary Clinton getting up and saying that women's rights are human rights. And so this commission came out of that. What it really accomplishes? Well, I assume that there are meetings, there are reports, expert panel discussions, that sort of thing, that attempt to improve the status of women and to improve gender equity around the world.
Other countries, and you alluded to this earlier, that have a poor record of protecting women are part of this organization. I think of Pakistan, Somalia, Afghanistan. Why are they allowed to be there?
Very good question. Afghanistan, I believe, didn't even bother to vote. Look, these are political decisions. The memberships are usually divided geographically. Asia gets so many, Africa gets so many, Europe gets so many, and often there is really no rhyme or reason. But there is still, I think, some utility. After all, this is a way in which the world can discuss issues like these, and all countries in the world can be included in those discussions. And as we've seen today, it's also a way of showing displeasure if a particular member is seen as egregiously violating human rights.
Before today's vote, Iran had argued that expelling them from the commission would ultimately prevent other member states with different cultures, customs, and traditions from contributing to similar commissions. That was a quote. Does that point of view hold much sway at the UN?
I don't think so. I think every country that gets a chance to be on one of these committees takes it.
Iran expert Barbara Slavin is soon to be a senior fellow at the Stimson Center. She joined us from Washington. Always good to speak with you, Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here's a sad statistic from the natural world. Globally, more than 1 million species face extinction. Environmental leaders are in Montreal right now at a UN meeting aiming to finalize an agreement to protect those plants and animals and nature as a whole. Now there's an emerging scientific movement that's looking at preserving cultural diversity as a way to do that. The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has an example from off the coast of the Caribbean island of Dominica.
Reach! You see that one? Straight ahead!
Canadian biologist Shane Garrow knows the sperm whale populations here so well, the heading out to sea is kind of like going to a family reunion for him.
There are some families we haven't seen in a long time that I'd love to see. Family J. It'd be great to check in with them. They had a little baby named Jonah, and we'd love to see her again.
That's one of more than 30 families Garrow has documented here off the mountainous coast of Dominica, and more than a decade and a half of research.
So we're really sort of building a family album of the families that live here.
He can identify some individuals just by their dorsal fins, small bumps on bodies the size of school buses. Globally, sperm whales are endangered. Of the 16 families that spend the most time here, Garrow has documented 12 of them shrinking.
So this isn't, you know, mathematical modeling. This is individual whales that we know vanishing.
Sperm whales used to be hunted for the waxy substance found in their massive heads, which was used in oil lamps and candles. Today, entanglement in fishing nets and ship strikes are the main threats. This sound is from a research trip in March of 2020, just before the pandemic put scientific fieldwork on pause. Garrow and his team at the Dominica Sperm Whale Project were searching for whales, using hydrophones to listen for their clicks.
I can't tell if it's sperm whale clicks. And it's, you know, when you hear them dolphins and then it's
Yeah, let's get a directional and point towards it, and then I'll take a listen.
Using these underwater recordings, Garrow has identified sequences of clicks that are unique to each clan here. They're a way for those whales to say, hey, I'm a member of this tribe.
So the Eastern Caribbean clan that we spend most of our time with here makes the 1+1+3.
Here's what that sounds like recorded underwater. Another clan that lives in bigger families and speeds through here instead of hanging out, he says.
Never make that pattern, but they make what we call a 5R3, which sounds like this.
Garrow says these click patterns are learned. It takes a couple of years for a mama whale, for example, one Garrow has named Fingers, to teach her calf Digit.
Well, I'm hearing them on the hydrophone, and it's loud, very loud.
As we look for whales out on the water, Garrow explains that to him, this is a sign that each clan has its own unique culture, which is important to their survival.
Because what Fingers is teaching Digit, and Digit will hopefully teach her calf, is how to live here. It connects to this part of the ocean, and they succeed here.
Garrow, who is a scientist in residence at Canada's Carleton University, is currently studying whether there are other learned behaviors that make the clan unique. So far, he's found that the Eastern Caribbean clan prefers the waters off of Dominica to other equally good habitats, making it a kind of traditional homeland.
And so if they all disappear, what we've lost is all of the secrets of how to succeed in the Caribbean.
In the Pacific, sperm whale clans have been shown to differ in their movement, diet, and social behaviors. And these different clans seem to do better in different weather conditions.
So as our climate races towards ever faster change, we need to pay attention to that in the way that we conserve these species. It's not just about genetics and numbers. It's also about preserving cultural diversity.
At the UN summit in Montreal this week, cultural diversity is not explicitly mentioned in the draft agreement on protecting nature.
But I think we could argue that it is sort of inadvertently.
Philippa Brakes is a leading voice on animal cultures and a researcher at a nonprofit called Whale and Dolphin Conservation. She says that a focus on protecting connected habitats in the UN biodiversity framework is important. That will allow migratory species to continue to travel freely and teach the next generation about the best feeding and breeding grounds, for example.
So how information is shared between these animals is already in some ways sort of tacitly, if you like, integrated into the work that many conservation bodies do.
That was a little one.
Back off the coast of Dominica, Garrow and his crew are heading in after a day on the water.
What a day!
As the late afternoon sun starts to glint off the ocean, a pod of pilot whales glides past the boat. Dolphins race under it, then porpoise right in front of us.
Sunset leaping. Oh, they're right on the bow.
Preserving cultural diversity in the animal kingdom will be a challenge. Many creatures haven't been studied enough to understand their specific cultures, how they hunt or communicate differently than their neighbors.
But all sorts of animals, whether it's primates or elephants, you know, megafauna down to bumblebees and lizards and all sorts of smaller animals learn from each other. And so the question is, how do we figure all of that out in time to protect them?
At the moment, scientists say we're losing animal cultures faster than we can measure them. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
New Zealand is taking a novel approach to cutting tobacco use, making it illegal to start smoking. A new law passed this week forbids tobacco from ever being sold to anybody born on or after January 1st, 2009. That is, current 12 and 13-year-olds. Chris Bullen researches smoking at the University of Auckland and explained the idea on the world when the bill was introduced last year.
If you're born after a certain year, then you will never be able to buy tobacco. So let's say if you're born in 2009, 2010, 2011, that whole cohort, it will be illegal for them to be sold tobacco.
The minimum age for buying cigarettes in New Zealand will keep going up and up. So in theory, somebody trying to buy a pack of cigarettes 50 years from now would need ID to show they were at least 63 years old. The war in Ukraine has overshadowed smaller ongoing conflicts in the region. This fall, for example, fighting erupted along contested borders in the Caucasus and in Central Asia, including fighting between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. The fighting lasted just 4 days, but it temporarily displaced nearly 140,000 people. As Levi Bridges reports from Kyrgyzstan's capital, Bishkek, the conflict has ignited a fierce discussion about identity and Russia's legacy as a colonial power.
Inside a small house in Bishkek, kids are playing with their mother as a light snow falls outside. The family left their home on the border with Tajikistan after war broke out this fall. The children's mother didn't want me to use her name for security reasons. Her hometown has been attacked by soldiers from an authoritarian country with no free press. She says her children are traumatized. When the kids hear loud sounds from the street, they think it's the Tajiks shooting, she says. The family relocated here to get medical help because her 11-year-old son developed a skin condition after the war called psoriasis that can be caused by stress. She unbuttons her son's coat to show me large red marks on his arms and chest. This is all devastating for his mother. She says the border used to be a peaceful place. She says Tajik women used to cross the border to do farm work. She calls the Tajiks sisters. Tajikistan is an authoritarian country, ruled by a president who's been in power longer than Putin. Kyrgyzstan is the most democratic country in Central Asia. Much of the border between the two countries isn't demarcated. Border clashes are common, but the violence this year was unprecedented. Kyrgyzstan received the worst of it, with schools destroyed and dozens of houses burnt by Tajiks. In a video, Tajik soldiers in a Kyrgyz border town raise a Tajik flag over a school as black smoke fills the sky. Tajiks later retreated, and the war ended in a ceasefire. Both sides accused the other of starting the conflict. Sinat Sultanalyeva is a researcher in Kyrgyzstan with Human Rights Watch. She says it's hard to fully understand what happened because there's almost no freedom of the press in Tajikistan. And it's dangerous for Tajiks on the ground to work with outside research organizations.
Because any contact with foreign-based NGOs or journalists, anybody who's not Tajik, can make them vulnerable to state persecution for treason, basically.
Because Kyrgyzstan is more democratic, it receives lots of Western support. But during the fighting, many Kyrgyz felt like the international community was so focused on Ukraine that they'd been forgotten. Here's some videos posted on social media.
Dear world, I know you're very tired of any news about the war, but we really need your help here in Kyrgyzstan.
Dear Western media, I know that we are not white enough for you to care that much.
Those feelings persist even after the war. Asiel Dulkaldieva, a political ethnographer in Bishkek, says she's frustrated that Kyrgyzstan only gets covered in the Western media through the ways it's connected to major political powers, like Russia.
It's a very humiliating and detrimental to the local populations because we don't know how to otherwise attract attention.
Dulkaldieva says that many Kyrgyz want to separate from Russia and engage with the international community. But it's hard because Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan belong to a Moscow-led security bloc, similar to NATO. But Russia failed to intervene and restore peace between them. Dula Kaldeyeva says Russia's actions this year have been a powerful wake-up call.
Because it means that Russia is not a guarantor of security, it is a liability in the region.
That reality makes many people in Kyrgyzstan fear that Russia played a sinister role in the recent war. Many Kyrgyz suspect Russia asked Tajikistan to invade their country, perhaps because Kyrgyzstan's government doesn't support Russia's invasion. Sinat Sotanayeva of Human Rights Watch says there's no direct evidence of this, but she says Russia has caused so much fear in the region, there's concern that nationalism is on the rise in many countries.
And nationalism fuels suspicion and paranoia. And that's definitely what's happening in the region, the whole of the post-Soviet space.
Sotanayeva specified these are her personal theories, not those of Human Rights Watch. More nationalistic views here are also playing out in efforts to dismantle symbolic memories of Russia's status as a colonial power. For example, Kyrgyz are now demanding that Russians stop calling their country Kyrgyzia, like it was during the Soviet Union.
The whole collapse of the Soviet Union, it's been protracted in time, it's not over. And maybe this is the final stage of it finally kind of collapsing.
Unfortunately, this process is also playing out through multiple violent conflicts. Sotanayeva says many people on Kyrgyzstan's border keep their bags packed, so they're ready to flee when the fighting starts again. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
Finally today, a short story about how a musical style evolves over time. This is the sound of high life music from Ghana, performed by a veteran of the style, Gedouble Ambole. High life has its origins in the West African sounds of what's known as palm wine music, chilled out rhythms that were the product of guitars brought from Portugal during colonization in the 15th century, then mixed with local melodies and a bit of calypso from the Caribbean. Fast forward to the 19th century, palm wine music took on the brass instruments from Britain's colonial military, and that became high life. Gedouble Ambole began his musical career in the late 1960s playing a pure version of highlife. That's continued with his ensemble you're hearing, the Sekondi Band. But in keeping up with the times, Ambole has also been one of the main drivers behind hiplife, a combination of hip-hop and highlife. And now, this. Thelonious Monk's classic Round Midnight, one of several jazz standards that Gedouble Ambole gave the highlife treatment to this year. In that spirit of innovation, we leave you today with sounds old and new. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Take care, and we'll see you again tomorrow. Hi there, Marco here. Before we go, we are nearing our deadline to unlock a $67,000 matching gift, and we need your help to do it. If you value The World's human-centered coverage, and if you can't imagine your world without The World, please donate today. Visit theworld.org/give. Thank you very much, and be well.